what I call it. Do we have our bailiffs in court? You guys, okay. Are both parties ready?
The colors are ready, Your Honor.
Thank you. Just some housekeeping matters. Argument is set for half hour for each side, and appellate, you have to keep track of your time, and we're ready to proceed. Please state your name as you start.
May it please the court. My name is Tim Buchanan, and I represent the San Antonio, Los Pinos, and Canales River Acequia Preservation Association and Save Our Senior Water Rights, LLC. Also appearing with me today is Stefan Atencio, representing Richard H. Ramstetter and Peter Atkins. I will be making the argument on behalf of our respective clients. The issues presented in this appeal will determine whether the promise of the Water Right Determination and Administration Act of 1969 will finally provide the constitutional protections to senior water rights within the San Luis Valley. The senior water rights that have, that are seeking redress in this court, that endured over half a century of failure to administer well pumping within the San Luis Valley and the deprivation to their senior water rights. To put a scale on the scope of the issue here, the court found below that approximately 265,000 acre feet of water is pumped from the wells located within one sub-district that is before you today. Of that amount, 200,000 of it is fully consumed. Yet, as a result of the conditions or the lack of conditions that the court has placed on the operation of the plan of water management, in 2009, only 7,200 acre feet of depletions are considered to have occurred to the Rio Grande River. This is only one sub-district. There are many more that are proposed, and that will look to this opinion and this issue to decide the ultimate direction that goes in the San Luis Valley. A plan of water management, which is the issue that has been brought before this court, has been described as a new concept or a different approach than a plan for augmentation that has been the mainstay of allowing out-of-priority diversions. Through the plan for augmentation, there has been developed a careful and consistent body of law that ensures protection of senior water rights. Both the plan for water management and the plan for augmentation, or any other concept that is developed, must meet the statutory and constitutional protections embodied in the 1969 Act and the Colorado Constitution. To the extent a plan for water management fails to meet the statutory and constitutional required standards, the plan must be rejected. The Division III Court acknowledges that a plan of water management must provide terms and conditions to prevent injury to senior water rights, but fails to include all of the requirements of law in order to ensure that the water rights will be protected. The May 27 decree, that is the issue of this appeal, fails to include all of the concepts that were required by statute for plans of water management and have been required by this court in order to ensure constitutional protection to senior water rights. A paramount issue that needs to be determined in this proceeding is whether the Water Court in and for Water Division Number 3 has the authority to approve a plan of water management that essentially refers a plan to the state engineer for annual determinations as to the terms and conditions for the plan of water management. We submit that the body of law that has been developed does not allow the state engineer to make these determinations.
Can I ask you a question? It wasn't totally clear for me. For me, from the briefs, are you arguing that parts of the statute are unconstitutional?
But we are not arguing that the parts of the statute are unconstitutional. What we are arguing is that the plan of water management must both comply with the statutory provisions and comply with the other determinations of this court that are necessary in order to prevent injury to other senior water rights.
Well, that's set out in the statute, is it not, that 4A, 3792, 501, 4A, continue use of underground water consistent with preventing material injury to senior service water rights?
That is correct.
Isn't that what the plan as amended, combined with the decreed conditions, do, at least in Judge Keenhold's view?
In Judge Keenhold's view, it is a compliance with the statutory standard. But there are other provisions of the statutes besides just the service, lip service of must protect senior water rights. The statute requires that the plan be a comprehensive, detailed plan, which the plan is not. The one cannot pick up this plan and determine how the methodology will be utilized to determine the well pumping. There is no metering requirement. There is no monitoring requirement. There are no other requirements except every year the state engineer will review a plan. It's on page 133 of the court's decree that says he'll review the plan, determine the engineering sufficiency, and submit that plan. If that plan is approved by the water court, or let me restate that, if it's approved by the state engineer, we then, as objectors, have 14 days in which to submit a detailed objection to that plan.
Now, that's under the court's retained jurisdiction?
That is under the court's retained jurisdiction.
Right. And who bears the burden of proof of showing the injury or lack of injury at that point, in your view?
We bear the burden of proof because the court expressly determined that it would review the plan for reasonableness and whether the plan was arbitrary and capricious. So the burden of proof is now shifted to the objector.
You mean the annual element of the plan? I'm not sure that I read the court's decree and stipulations to say that. I thought it said that based on forecasting, then at the end of the year, the sub-district had to recompense the injury if the forecast proved to be inaccurate and make it whole, basically. And it seemed to me the burden is on the sub-district under that viewpoint to show that the injury has not occurred. Now, there is this 50-acre-foot total that has to do with the, you know, the reasonable accuracies of the model, but certainly the judge's, the appendices to the amended plan and the judge's decree seems to me set up a situation where no material injury will be the result of the implementation of this plan. You disagree, and if so, what do you take exception with in the judge's findings, conclusions, and decree?
Well, I strongly disagree with that. And let me just reference in your first comment about whether this is on the annual plan, you have to submit these objections, and whether the standard would then be the arbitrary and capricious standard. And on page 134 of the judge's order, paragraph 8, it expressly says, with respect to the annual replacement plans, those standards would apply if anyone objects to that standard. Now, coming back to the other...
Now, I want to be clear on this now. There's a procedure for a protest to be made, right, to the annual element of the plan to get the retained jurisdiction. And it seemed to be very clear from the first order of the court remanding this to the sub-district and then is further finding that, you know, past depletions that have a future effect on the stream, that are being fell on the stream, have to be taken care of. He added a number, it seemed to me, of no injury criteria to the final decree that's in front of us.
Well, part of the problem is the court did add conditions to the plan. If you look at the statute under 3726, it expressly says that the court shall adopt, refer back, or reject the plan. And the court does not have the opportunity to impose its own terms and conditions. In the 2009 order of the court recognized that. But in the 2010 final decree of the court stated that it was going to impose its own terms and conditions and came up with approximately 17 conditions that would have to be met. There's a very good reason why it was set up to be adopt, reject, or refer back. And that is because the statute under 3748.126 expressly says what's to happen if the court takes one of the...
Well, you want us to read out these decree conditions that the water judge put in, including those that have to do with the retained jurisdiction?
I'm sorry.
You're saying he doesn't have authority to put out the provisions for the use of the retained jurisdiction? Retained jurisdiction is mentioned right in the statute itself, does it not?
I'm not objecting necessarily to the retained jurisdiction. What I'm objecting to is the procedure that the court has set forth of imposing its own conditions and then deciding on an annual basis as to whether the plan will cause injury, and then retaining jurisdiction without ever making the finding that the plan will not cause material injury to other vested water rights. That finding was not made in this case. What the court found was that it would review this process. It would see whether the plan met what they aspired to do. But the court did not find that there would be no material injury because there weren't enough terms and conditions incorporated in the plan. So, unlike what the court allowed in the South Park case, where the court said retained jurisdiction is not a tool to allow the plan to have a wait and see operation. Well, that is precisely what is going on in this case. The court has said, we will see how it goes every year, and I will become basically a master in this case. If anybody doesn't like what's going on, you have 14 days. There's never any testimony as to whether 14 days was appropriate. There's never any evidence as to whether people in the valley use computers and can find the websites and find this information so that they can make that timely objection. There was never any evidence about any of those items. All the court did was adopted additional plans and conditions that it incorporated into the plan, and those conditions then essentially provided that on an annual basis, we will have this plan adopted by the state engineer, and if anybody doesn't like it, you come back in, and you have the burden of proof to prove that there's a problem with it. Otherwise, unless it's arbitrary or capricious or unreasonable, the court will approve it.
Mr. Buchanan, earlier you were about to explain sort of what the underlying purpose was, according to you, of the statutes, of the fact that the statute, in your view, does not permit the court to add conditions. And I think where you were headed is because of what happens after the court sends the plan back in some way. I think where you were going protects interests that the court has not been protecting. Would you just complete that argument, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The concept behind the plans of water management is it expressly puts forth the concept of adopt, reject, or refer back. And then in the next provision of 3748.126, it says what should happen if the court adopts the plan, then that becomes the final plan. And it's to be filed with the clerk and recorder, and that is the end of it. If the court rejects the plan, there's the obligation of the sub-district to go back and do another hearings, do other proceedings to allow people to express their conditions or their concerns and to try to protect their water rights. And the third option is if the court refers back, then the court is to set the hearing for a time certain, and the sub-district is to hold additional hearings, develop terms and conditions that can then be incorporated into the plan and address the issues. Unlike a plan for augmentation, that proceeding doesn't happen under the plan for augmentation process. What happens under a plan for augmentation is under 3792.304, the court, if they cannot find no material injury associated with the plan, the court will grant the applicant leave to propose additional terms and conditions. and a court can have an additional hearing on that. Very different concepts associated with why the court cannot propose its own terms and conditions, because none of the parties will know and are not allowed to present their own terms and conditions in the plan of water management process. Among the terms and conditions that the court has indicated, as I've already stated, is the state engineer is given the authority under the terms of this plan to develop those plans. This court has not allowed, and there is no statutory provision, for referral of a plan to the state engineer. The state engineer was not granted any express authority under the terms of either statutes that provided for the plans of water management under 3745-126 or under the 1969 Act. There were no provisions granting the state engineer that additional authority. This court in Empire Lodge and Bijou expressly stated that the state engineer does not have the authority to adjudicate the waterways. That's the province of the water court. The water court is required under the plan for water management concept to develop the terms and conditions, or to review the terms and conditions and ensure that those terms and conditions will prevent material injury, not refer to the state engineer. The other part,
you're saying the state engineer has no authority over these plans?
Well, that's
or the approval of these plans?
The state engineer does an initial approval after it's adopted by the sub-district. State engineer reviews it, determines if it's appropriate under the state engineer's criteria. State engineer doesn't hold any hearings. The state engineer doesn't have any conferences. He just decides on his own if it's appropriate. Then, if somebody objects to the state engineer's approval, you appeal it to the water court. And that's precisely what happened in this case. But there was never any provision in statute for this annual plan for the state engineer to approve it and have anybody who didn't like it or were concerned about the injury to their water rights to object at that time. I'd like to follow up on that comment, though. One other point about that is once wells are included in the plan, the state engineer is prohibited by statute from shutting down the well. So we have this.
As long as there's no injury that results to water rights, is it?
Actually, the statute is a little different than that. The statute says that as long as they are operating pursuant to the plan, the state engineer cannot shut them down. So,
but the plan has conditions that require the replacement of injury and the prevention of injury. Isn't that right?
No, it doesn't. That's part of the fundamental problem here. Is the
plan. So we can't take into account the decree conditions that the water judge added as a result of his decree. What in the statute prevents that?
It
seems to me you're arguing that's the augmentation statute, and we've got different authority in Division 3 for a different kind of groundwater basin interaction with the stream management plan here that the legislature wanted to put forward as an alternative to the strict augmentation plan curtailment requirements that are applicable, for example, in the Platte Basin.
What I've argued is strictly arguing under the terms of the plan for water management statute. The plan for water management statute says that there shall be no material injury, that it shall be a detailed and comprehensive plan. And we do not have a detailed and comprehensive plan because no one can pick up this plan and know what the state engineer will decide to do next year, the following year, the third year, as part of his annual approval, which is a concept that was never presented to the court, which is a concept that the court developed on its own without any authority, because of the unique nature of the plans of water management. It had to be sent back. It had to be referred back to the sub-district to hold the appropriate hearings. In lieu of that, the court has decided that the court will impose its own terms and conditions, and those terms and conditions are part of the concern that we raise here. The other part of the concern is that the plan does not have appropriate treatment of various water rights in accordance with Colorado law. For example, the statute expressly provides that credit is not to be given for phreatophytes removal. Yet, in operation of the model, the plan allows credit to be given for removal of phreatophytes. The plan also provides that it will take recharge water that belongs to third parties for which the sub-district has no contract, no agreement, no other relationship other than they are in the sub-district. They will take their water and it will take credit for the water that is recharged to the aquifer by those parties. No agreements, no compensation. All that occurs is the sub-district takes it. As a result, even though there's 200,000 acre feet of consumptive use occurring within this one sub-district, the amount of depletion is quite small to the river, in large part because of the phreatophyte credit and because of the credit that is received from recharge decrees for which the sub-district has no lawful authority.
And so can I just follow up on your exchange with Justice Coates? So essentially your argument is that the judge here could have approved it, but in order to prove it would have to say no injury, correct?
That's
and the judge didn't do that. And if the judge has concerns, gosh, I have some concerns here. There is no statutory authority to add conditions.
That is correct, and that was illustrated in the 2009 order from the court. The court said it back, listed out the court's concerns and objections, sent it back to the sub-district. The sub-district adopted additional terms and conditions, held hearings, sent it back to the court, and the court reviewed it. And so that should have been the procedure of the court. It should have sent it back and allowed the sub-district to, again, try to ensure that senior water rights were not going to be adversely affected and to ensure that it was a comprehensive and detailed plan.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Okay.
Chief Justice Bender, may it please the court. My name is David Robbins. I am counsel for the Rio Grande Water Conservation District and Subdistrict Number 1. I will be arguing the case on behalf of the supporters of the plan of management who are appellees in this matter. I realize that it's a bit unusual, but I wish to introduce my co-counsel. The development and defense of this plan has resulted in a unique team effort, and their names should be made familiar to you. At council table with me is Assistant Attorney General Peter Ampey, and in the audience is Mari Dominski for the state engineer. William Paddock for the Rio Grande Water Users is here, as is Richard Marin for the Canales Water Conservancy District, Bill Hellhouse and Matthew Merrill for Farming Technologies, and John McClure for Skyview. And finally, I'd like to recognize my partners, Dennis Montgomery and Jennifer Hunt, as well as Nate Flynn of our office, and of course, recovering attorney Ingrid Barrier. Their collective efforts have been invaluable. This case, more than most, brings into focus the truth of the aphorism, no good deed goes unpunished. Because this case is not really about what's happened in the San Luis Valley and what the state engineer has or hasn't done over the past 40 years or however many. It's really about the culmination of the voluntary efforts of a group of farmers and ranchers who decided to try and solve the joint problems of groundwater overdraft and the need to replace injurious depletions occurring to senior water rights by themselves, collectively, not as individuals competing for the resource, but as a community. They began the task in 2003. They did it not in response to regulations from the state, because none were pending at the time. The state was involved in the massive task of developing the Rio Grande Decision Support System and its related models, which the state intended to use for purposes of regulating the wells. They stepped ahead and decided that they would try to solve the problem.
The original plan had serious flaws in it. The water judge found that it did not protect against injury under these special legislation that has to do with Division III. So what's your response to the question about whether this plan protects against material injury to surface water rights?
Well, first, Justice Hobbs, let me respond affirmatively to your point that the original plan was found to be wanting. I want to make it, and before I address the injury question, I want to make it clear that the first plan reflected just exactly what I described, a community of farmers and ranchers who were trying to get the system back in balance. And truly, they did not focus as directly in that first plan on replacement of injurious depletions as they did upon the idea that if they recovered their aquifer, the injurious depletions would follow. Judge Keenhove said, no, you've got this backwards. You need to recover your aquifer. We agree with that. But you also need to prevent injurious depletion to senior water rights. That same group of individuals, now the Board of Managers, went back and worked diligently to produce the five appendices to the plan with the express purpose of highlighting how they would go about gathering the water, identifying the injurious depletions, and replacing them at the time and place. The plan does do that. And if you read Judge Keenhove's opinion, you will see that he finds that if the terms of the plan of management are followed, injurious depletions will be replaced.
Well, has the sub-district and the state engineer embraced these decree conditions that Judge Keenhove added to make sure that happens?
Absolutely, and you will know, I hope, that there has been no appeal of any provision of Judge Keenhove's decision. It was accepted by the supporters, it is embraced by the supporters, and it is, and were it approved, it will be followed by the supporters. Now, I'd like, if I may, well, in response to that question and in further response, point out to you that these conditions that Judge Keenhove applied are hardly of the nature that the appellants suggest. They are more in the form of the type of conditions that a court of general jurisdiction would impose in any supervisory type decree. They involve things of how you should provide notice, when you should file the replacement plan, how it's going to be posted so there's public information, how there will be challenges, how the fact that he intends to review the budget and accounting each year, the fact that there need to be rules and regulations, and the type of notice that is expected as those are developed. All of these things, from my perspective, and I would urge upon the court, are not new sort of terms and conditions that the Board of Managers should have had the prescience to include, but they are the sort of things that any judge who is going to have a statutorily obligated supervisory responsibility would include in the approval. To say, these are the things I'm going to be looking for, and if you don't do it, you're not going to get there with me on your annual plans. And so I don't believe that there is any infirmity in a court decree that provides that sort of supervisory language. The plan itself, which the judge approved, is complete in and of itself, within its four corners. The supervisory conditions don't add to that plan. They give information about how that plan is going to be viewed by the court in coming years.
Well, counsel, so I guess just to follow up on that, so then you would disagree that, I mean, the plan is fine without the conditions. It stands on its own, and it the court said no injury.
The court found that the plan, if followed, would not create injury. That is correct. And the judge could easily have approved the plan without the conditions and then gone ahead and imposed them in the first year to the surprise of the supporters if some of them you know, were different than what, you know, what had been expected. I think the judge was simply saying, here are the sort of things we're going to have to look at to make absolutely certain that there is full public knowledge of how this is proceeding, to make certain that the concerns that Mr. Buchanan has expressed can be addressed each year so this plan can go forward.
Do you think, though, I mean, I guess Mr. Buchanan's point is that those were adopted, those extra conditions, without basically any process. I've just been wondering if you could respond to that argument, that basically that the court should have said, I'm sorry, this doesn't adequately protect against injury, go back and come up with some other conditions, as opposed to making them up at that point.
Justice, I understand exactly that point. As in augmentation cases, there is notice given, parties appear, often a trial is held, terms and conditions are proposed. There's no limitation on those terms and conditions. The court adopts them. Everyone who participated gets notice of them. And when the decree is entered, there is again notice of those terms and conditions. Here, we had a long trial. The judge did propose terms and conditions. He specifically found that no level of detail in this plan, in his view, would satisfy the objectors, and that it was a useless exercise every time he saw something that he thought was necessary as a supervisory judge over the plan, as the legislature had directed, to send it back to go through an entire six-month public process in which the Board of Managers has hearings, the River Bend Water Conservation District has hearings, the notice is published, it comes back to the court. He chose instead, and rightly, I believe, to press ahead to accomplish exactly what the objectors seek, which is the beginning of replacement of injurious depletions to senior surface water rights. It's a little bit preposterous to be here today fighting about an effort to do exactly what the objectors want, and to find ourselves in a position where no matter what is done in an effort to accomplish that, there's a new procedural reason why it should not be allowed. Now, along those lines, I want to make it absolutely clear to the court. The council argued that in the case of phreatophytes, the plan of management somehow gave the well owners a walk. I want to be very clear that nothing in this plan of management talks about phreatophytes or the water consumed by phreatophytes. Phreatophytes are a natural condition in the San Luis Valley, and I want to read what Dr. Charles Brendicke said about them and their inclusion in the groundwater model. The phreatophytes are a component of the state's groundwater model, which the court has said is an adequate way to identify depletions. The plan of management does nothing with phreatophytes. It takes the output from the model. Dr. Brennecke said, this nonlinear process is a fundamental aspect of the hydrology and vegetation of the valley, and it exists with or without human intervention. It is represented in the RGDSS groundwater model because the model seeks to represent accurately all the important processes affecting the valley's aquifer system and groundwater budget, and he goes on. I want to make it clear, the plan of management is intended to increase the level of the groundwater in the San Luis Valley, to restore the aquifer systems as the legislature suggested. When that happens, what do the phreatophytes, the native vegetation, what happens? They use more water, not less. So the plan of management does exactly the opposite from what council suggests to you, because there is no water that is salvaged or available for replacement, because more is being used, not less. I want to make it clear that the plan of management does not, quote, take other people's water rights and apply them to the plan in the form of the recharge decrees. It simply accounts for the fact that there is water of a form, legally, that is the same as Trans Mountain water within the sub-district that is able to be freely pumped because it was diverted from the river in priority and applied to the groundwater reservoir and then withdrawn subsequently by wells, to account for the legal withdrawal of this groundwater. It cannot be injurious to pump water that has legally been put in the system for later withdrawal.
The question I heard, or the allegation I heard, was that perhaps the recharge rights have been taken from those who own it and sort of converted by the sub-district. What is your response to that? This water that's taken in from the Rio Grande that is brought in, that's the imported water that is the fully consumable water. Who owns that under this plan?
This plan does not, and by its terms specifically, does not seek to assert title to any water rights. Under this plan, and under the way in which the accounting has been done, you have to take into account the existence of the water, not who owns it. If an individual, the water belongs to the ditch companies and to the Rio Grande water users. There are 5 decrees that allow water to come in for storage in the underground aquifer. The ditch companies are entitled to that water. The ditch companies appoint the board of directors or the board of managers. The shareholders in the ditch companies, should they seek to acquire the right to use their prorated share of the water, are entitled to do that. There's nothing in the plan that would stop them. They could try to form their own augmentation plan and rely on that water. What would happen? That amount of water would not be accounted for then in the sub-basin, in the sub-district's accounting procedures. And what pumping from those wells would not be replaced either. And we would go on down the road. But it is disingenuous to suggest to this court that that water is not there, that those wells are not pumping that water, and suggest that the results of that pumping ought to be treated as unreplaced pumping, as if there wasn't any water put into groundwater storage in the first place. That's basically the argument. The converse is true. All that's going on here is an accounting to make certain that there is credit given to all of these wells within the sub-district who, with a different hat on, as members of irrigation ditches, have placed water into the ground under decrees that say they can take it back out. Okay, so let's not think that the sub-district is here trying to take anybody's property. They're not. They're trying to account, in conjunction with the decision support system groundwater model, how this all works, so they can get at an accurate statement of how much water is owed where and when to each of the streams. I wanted to quickly address a question Justice Hobbs asked earlier of my opposing counsel, and that had to do with the 50-acre feet as what appeared to be viewed as a limit. The 50-acre feet, it's just a mathematical calculation that the court went through and discussed at trial, that is the application of an accuracy factor that all of the engineers agreed was the appropriate accuracy, which was that this model, this huge basin scale model, could not get to an accuracy below 0.05% of the stress applied, 0.05% of the stress applied. That's where that number comes from. It's not an effort to say if there are 50 feet of identified solutions, you don't have to replace them. What it says is, we don't know when we are looking at stresses that are below 0.05%, whether or not there's anything there or not. This model can't do that. And the judge acknowledged that, and one of his conditions was simply to say, we're going to keep working on this model. We're going to collect information from well metering. We're going to improve the model. And as we do, that number, that percentage, that calculation is going to change, and I'm going to expect that the annual plans track that, so that as we move down the road, and we get a more and more precise model, that the amount of depletion that may be calculated is going to change as well. Now, let me just say along that line, so that we're very clear here, this plan had the legislature in Senate Bill 222 required not one thing. It didn't just require that we had to replace injurious depletions. It also required that there had to be sustainability in the aquifer systems, restoration and sustainability. So the plan has to provide, has to accomplish two functions, not one. And the first function, as Justice Hobbs correctly pointed out, is the one that Judge Keenel said, you didn't emphasize it on the front end, go back and do it again, and they did. That's to replace injurious depletions calculated by the model. The second, sustaining the aquifer, is equally important. Why? Because if you withdraw ground from production, you stop pumping. When you stop pumping, you reduce the stress on the aquifer. When you reduce the stress on the aquifer, you reduce the depletions to the stream flow, or so we believe. The result of that, of course, is the replacement water that is required goes down. There you have a very excellent reason why this plan is set up to roll annually, so that as the aquifer conditions change and hopefully improve, the amount of replacement water will change and the conditions in the system will change, and each year the plan of management will deal with those factors. After all, the plan of management is an economic tool first and foremost.
Well, I wonder about that. 3792.501.4c refers to the water judge shall retain jurisdiction over the water management plan for the purpose of ensuring the plan is operated and injuries prevented in conforming with the terms of the court's decree approving the water management plan. So there's approval authority. It's talking about the court's decree. My question to you is, under this retained jurisdiction, if it's invoked, who has the burden of showing non-injury to water rights?
Well, in the first instance, every year, the burden is on the sub-district, of course. The sub-district has to present an annual plan that fully satisfies the obligation to replace injurious depletions. It has to identify the water supplies that it will use. It has to identify how those water supplies will arrive at the point of the injurious depletion. Not always an easy task. And it has to provide how those supplies are held so that the state engineer in the first instance has assurance that in fact in the coming year there will be the replacement that the plan contemplates and requires. That then goes to the court. If there is any disagreement with it, there is opportunity for hearing. But in the first instance, every year the burden of proof to establish the satisfaction, first of the state engineer and secondly of the water court, is on the sub-district. It is not a burden-shifting situation, in my opinion. Now, I want to make it absolutely clear that this is a hard process to figure out. It's never been done before.
Mr. Robbins?
Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Amp indicates that his opinion that it's a presumption under the statutory section that Justice Hobbs read, that there's a presumption that it's a presumption dictated by statute. So does that change the burden of proof? And do you agree with that?
Well,
I'm just quoting from his brief.
From Mr. Ante's brief?
Yes.
Yes.
He says, second, the standard review applied by the trial court is simply a presumption dictated by the statute.
Well, in my view, Mr. Chief Justice, and I don't wish to disagree with Mr. Ante's characterization, but in my view, the first thing every year is the obligation on the part of the sub-district to carry its burden that it has shown enough water and the capacity to deliver the water to the system in a way that will prevent...
That may have to do with the approval of the state engineer.
That's right.
It has to do with the plan.
That's right. That's exactly right.
The jury.
That's right.
Has to do with the state engineer's then approval of the plan.
Yes. She's entitled to a validity presumption. That's right.
Not who's carrying the burden first.
Council, could you perhaps explain a little bit about that engineer review process? Do any objectors have opportunity to present opposing views to the engineer as part of that review? How is that review conducted, that first review?
I am presuming that the first review, Justice Marcus, is conducted by the state engineer as he does his normal business, and that he does not hold some form of a hearing. I can't say for the state engineer that he would preclude third parties from offering their perspectives. He may decide through regulations or policies to allow that. But I think the way the system currently is set up, he would conduct his review, make his decision, at which point then any aggrieved party would have to appear.
A 14-day window.
Yes, okay. Yes, ma'am. I believe that's correct. Okay, now, let me get... I wanted to... I wanted to be sure that the court understands that in adopting Senate Bill 222, the legislature appears to have endeavored to address the unique hydrologic situation in the San Luis Valley and to provide a slightly different mechanism than might apply in other parts of the state. There are some technical reasons why that's the case. The first one is that, for example, in Divisions 1 and 2, the South Platte and the Arkansas, you have basically alluvial aquifers connected to rivers, and the impacts from wells can be determined using a mathematical formula called the Glover formula. It's just a matter of how long does the pumping take to impact the river. That's not true in the San Luis Valley. As the evidence found by the trial judge suggests, the San Luis Valley is a very complicated hydrologic situation, and the Glover formula doesn't work. Pumping from wells in the San Luis Valley can have impacts miles away in a completely different stream system, as the model output has suggested, and as the judge's ruling suggests. And so it has been essential in the San Luis Valley to provide a tool that is other than just a standard plan of augmentation, a tool that allows management to occur and that recognizes that this system is going to be constantly changing in a nonlinear way. Nonlinear being 1 acre foot of pumping does not produce 1 acre foot of impact. And so what is happening here is that you see this basin struggling with how do we best meet the very standard that Mr. Buchanan correctly posits to you, which is there should be non-injury.
Well, there's some question about whether the rules and regulations of the state engineer should have been adopted first. And those aren't in place yet, so how do we know what the rules of the game are with regard to protecting against material injury?
We don't. Which leads me back to my opening point. No good deed goes unpunished. This subdistrict is an effort to get the problem solved, whether the rules are in place or not. We certainly expect that the rules will be placed, it will be announced and put into place very soon. It is the expectation of the judge. It's certainly mine. But you are correct, Justice Hobbs. There are no rules in place at this time. But that doesn't change the burden that this plan proposes to assume. It proposes to use the groundwater model to identify depletions and to replace them, whether there are rules or not. It proposes that if rules present a more stringent obligation or a different obligation, that the plan will be adjusted to reflect the more stringent obligation. I'm not here to argue the historical fact that there aren't rules in place today. There are a lot of reasons for that. The Judge Keno lays them out in his decree. There was a lot of effort undertaken throughout the years to figure out how to manage the problem. And finally, we have water users who've stepped up and said, we're tired of waiting. We're going to figure out what to do. I want to talk briefly about the fact that this plan, and Judge Keenhold in his ruling places significant reliance on the legislature's direction in Senate Bill 222. He made extensive findings on how injury would be determined, on the level of the model's accuracy, and how plans would be developed to ensure full replacement of all identifiable injurious depletions. The tool to identify those depletions has already received scrutiny and acceptance in the Cotton Creek case. I want to be clear that there's no burden shifting here. This is an effort to identify what the depletions are and to ensure that they're replaced. The decree is very extensive in defining the quantities of depletion to be replaced and the methodology for how it will occur. The state engineer will annually apply the terms of the court decree in reviewing the annual plans that it will be done under this plan of management, and this state engineer's decision will be subject to scrutiny. At the end of the day, if injurious depletions are not replaced at the time and place identified by the model, the sub-district wells will be treated like every other well in the valley.
And to the what assures that? Does the statute assure that?
Well, the statute assures it, and the statute assures it in particular, and the plan of management itself assures it, that if, in fact, and the court's decree assures it, rather, not the plan, assures it that if, in fact, and the state engineer's testimony assures it, that if, in fact, replacement is not made, the wells will be curtailed in accordance with the rules and regulations. Obviously, that is a prospective challenge, but it is nonetheless the only challenge the sub-district has, because these wells are in a unique class right now. All of the other wells in the valley have not made any proposal at this time. They are, of course, waiting and hoping to make the proposal. This plan, the thing I want to leave you with is this plan is motivated by a sense of community and a desire to reduce the overall cost to that community as it addresses the dual requirements of replacement and sustainability. The alternative, urged by the objectors, is the extensive process of individual augmentation plans and the cost that is associated with them.
How do we know that the legislature didn't intend to have the augmentation statute apply?
Well, the legislature provided different standards. It provided a completely different process. Had it wanted the augmentation statute to apply, it had no reason to produce Senate Bill 222. And to emphasize the different goals that were going to be achieved in Division 3 versus what had been occurring in the other water divisions, just as it had done in Division 2, where it permitted a different approach to manage how well depletions would be handled on an annual basis. So there's no reason to have gone through the Senate Bill 222 process if, in fact, all we were going to do was simply begin to do augmentation plans. This is an effort to come up with a new way to move the doctrine of prior appropriation forward in the San Luis Valley with complete deference to the jurisprudence of this court, its expressions of concern about the need to replace depletions, and of course, the critical importance that at all times that the doctrine of prior appropriation has to be respected. And for a plan of this sort to be successful, those depletions have to be replaced in time and place. I thank you all for your courtesy. My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Rahm. Mr. Buchanan, rebuttal.
May it please the court. One of the issues that was raised in Mr. Robbins' argument was that it was preposterous for us to drop this appeal. However, this plan of water management is perpetual. And so whatever is decided in this plan or not included within this plan will affect the water users in the valley forever. The Alamosa, Ohio versus Gould decision was entered in 1983. Approximately 30 years ago, the court ordered that there should be appropriate rules and regulations adopted that will prevent injury to senior waterways. And we've seen nothing. And with all the good nature that may occur in the valley, I would note that Senate Bill 222 was enacted shortly after Empire Lodge was issued by this court, which required wells to get into the program, to get into the system and stop operating under this program that the state engineer had been operating for many years.
Well, the point of that opinion, if I recall it correctly, was that the legislature had not provided a mechanism that was an alternative to the augmentation plans that were in the 1969 Act. It appears that they have since spoken to your concern and enacted quite a bit different legislation than we've seen in the past. I mean, isn't that right?
Well, it is correct from the standpoint that their legislature had not vested the state engineer with authority to do what he was doing as described within Empire Lodge. The handwriting was on the wall. All those operations that had been operating under the good graces of the state engineer immediately had to do something. Part of the reaction was for this one location in the state, Water Division Number 3, plans of water management could be adopted. Every other division in the state only has the opportunity to do an augmentation plan. So within this one area, Water Division Number 3, there is this special opportunity. And we're not saying that this special opportunity cannot be used. All we are saying is that it has to meet the no material injury standard. It has to be comprehensive and complete. It has to comply with the statutory standards set forth in Senate Bill 2004-222 and 07-220. All of those standards that were set forth in those statutes must be incorporated into this plan. The comment was passed on or made that the district, the sub-district, just takes the output of the model, and therefore the recharge should be counted against it. The freatified use shouldn't be counted against it. A simple example explains the problem. If you take the output of the model, and the model says that there's 100 acre feet of depletions associated with raw pumping, and 40 acre feet of that would have been from phreatophytes, they get credit for 40 acre feet. So they're essentially taking credit for phreatophytes, and even though Senate Bill 222 expressly prohibited taking credit for phreatophytes, as well as the opinions of this court in Shelton Farms and RJA. Similarly,
well, those cases all had to do with subdividers of making water by paving roads and, you know, land surfaces, cutting down trees. I mean, this legislation says that this aquifer is entitled to fluctuate. In fact, part of the sustainability model is to get it back up, right? So we don't have a law that requires aquifers to lay at the root zone of phreatophytes, do we?
No, we don't have, and we're not suggesting that.
Okay.
What we're suggesting is that we comply with the very clear provision that says not recognize the reduction of water consumption by phreatophytes as a source of replacement water for new water uses or to replace existing depletions, or as a means to prevent injury to new water users.
Well, doesn't what the model does in this annual kind of check and recheck on it, you know, there's the forecast and then there's a recheck at the end of the year, look at actual depletions impact on the stream?
Not necessarily. First of all,
would you explain why that's not the process?
It's important to understand that the modeling is run by only one or two people in the state. There's only one or two people that understand how to run that model.
Right.
So we have no.
But it's the best tool we have according to the finding that the judge made based on the evidence. Right? And we use models all the time in these cases, don't we?
That's correct. And most models that are utilized in water cases are usable by other parties.
Right.
This one is not. It's only run by a handful of people. Those people make all decisions about how the inputs and how the outputs will be managed within that model. And so if that model, the decision is made that we will take credit for water that would have all gone to the phreatophytes, as the modeling has shown, and not require the replacement of depletions if the water would have gone to the phreatophytes, then the model does not accurately represent the operations. Similarly, if you take credit for the recharge water that belongs to various ditches and their shareholders, and that's the way you set up the model, the output is going to be much lower. That's how they can get these very low replacement obligations without having the need to consider a lot of the other depletions that are occurring. Because you can offset your depletions by recharge water, you can offset it by phreatophytes, so it reduces the volume that has to be replaced. The statute expressly prohibits use of phreatophytes. They have no lawful right to use the recharge water. Not one document was presented that shows that the recharge water could be used. Moreover, the procedures that were utilized in calculating the recharge amounts are different than the recharge decrees themselves. It's important to recognize the recharge decrees were actual decrees that were entered by the Water Division No. 3 Court. They were stipulated decrees in most cases. Various parties agreed to the terms and conditions, and when they were incorporated in the model, they used different terms and conditions. Those different terms and conditions are not consistent with the terms of the decree. Now, the judge gets around that by saying, oh, it honors the concept of the decree, but we have new and better information today. If that is so, then go back and change the decrees. But right now, the decree is the decree, and that should stand and not be modified by a simple wave of the hand. Those decrees are orders of the court that parties have relied on and have the opportunity to use. Another related factor is, aside from talking about the recharge water and the phreatophytes, but there is no other replacement water identified in this plan. And I indicated earlier that there is no ability to pick up this plan and see how it's going to operate so that we can then enforce the plan. And that is part of the reason why it has to be a complete and detailed plan, is because if we come back later on and say, under retained jurisdiction, this plan isn't working because they're not replacing the water with the right water. Sorry. The plan didn't require them to use that water. The plan didn't say they had to use a particular methodology. The plan didn't require these conditions. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of the court, I want to thank all the attorneys for the briefing and the arguments. Case will stand submitted on the briefs. The court will be in recess until 10:30 tomorrow.